more information on KPFA.org for January 26th. Kevin Powell.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 4 p.m. Stay tuned next for Hard Knock Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4. What up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we tackle key issues of the day. That's right, it's news, views, and hip-hop. All that and more coming up after the afternoon headlines.
I'm Mark Miracle with KPFA News Headlines. The Supreme Court stepped into a boiling political dispute over immigration today, setting up a likely decision in the middle of a presidential campaign marked by harsh rhetoric about immigrants. The justices agreed to review whether President Barack Obama, acting without congressional approval, has the power to shield from deportation up to 5 million immigrants living in the United States without documents and make them eligible to work without fear of being rounded up. Underscoring the political dimension, the case will be argued in April and decided by late June, about a month before both political parties gather for their nominating conventions. If Obama prevails against opponents led by Republican governors, there would be roughly 7 months left in his presidency to implement plans that would affect the parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, as well as some people who arrived in the United States before they turned 16. The Supreme Court justices rejected another challenge to the federal health law known as Obamacare. The justices left in place lower court rulings that dismissed a lawsuit against the national health care law. That suit argued that the law violates the provision of the Constitution that requires tax-raising bills to originate in the House of Representatives. The Supreme Court refused to revive an Arkansas law that would have banned abortions after the 12th week of pregnancy if doctors could detect a fetal heartbeat. Arkansas was appealing lower court rulings that struck the law down. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee joined health care workers and others to submit thousands of voter signatures to qualify a ballot initiative to raise California's minimum wage to $15 an hour. The Fair Wage Act of 2016 would raise the state's minimum wage to $11 in 2017 and then gradually increase it $1 a year until it reaches $15 an hour in 2021. Once the minimum wage reaches that mark, it will automatically be adjusted each year to keep pace with the cost of living. Proponents of a voter initiative to restrict public pensions in California say they will no longer try to get a measure on the ballot this year. Former San Jose Mayor Chuck Reed and former San Diego Councilman Carl DeMaia said they will instead pursue a ballot measure in November of 2018 when they expect a more favorable political environment. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump received an endorsement from conservative heavyweight Sarah Palin today. The former Alaska governor and former running mate of Senator John McCain in the 2008 presidential race endorsed the billionaire businessman In a statement, Trump's campaign said he's honored by the endorsement. The endorsement came just less than 2 weeks ahead of the leadoff Iowa caucus. Iowa Governor Terry Branstad says Iowans shouldn't not let Texas Senator Ted Cruz win the state's leadoff caucus because he opposes continued federal government support of ethanol. Branstad, speaking at a renewable fuels conference near Des Moines today, bluntly said he wants Cruz defeated in Iowa. A Republican who's not endorsed a candidate, Branstad says Iowans should not support anyone against something critically important to the economic well-being of Iowa. Cruz supports phasing out a federal policy that sets a minimum for the amount of ethanol blended in the nation's gas. Iowa leads the nation in ethanol production. Hillary Clinton received an endorsement for her bid for the Democratic nomination for president from the country's largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender civil rights organization. The Human Rights Campaign says it will work to mobilize its 1.5 million members and supporters ahead of the general elections. The White House is appointing a Health and Human Services Department official to lead federal efforts to help the city of Flint, Michigan deal with its water crisis. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said he anticipated that President Obama would meet with the city's mayor today. Mayor Karen Weaver had already visited with the White House's senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett, earlier. The crisis began in 2014 when a state appointed emergency manager switched Flint from Detroit's water to Flint River water to save money. Flint returned to the Detroit system after elevated levels of lead were discovered in children. And a top inspector general says some of the emails that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had on her home server were more sensitive than top secret. Inspector General for Intelligence Agencies Charles McCullough sent a letter to lawmakers last Friday saying that several dozen additional classified emails have been found. They include ones containing information from so-called special access programs, which have a classification higher than top secret. Details on these and other stories coming up on the evening news from Pacifica at 6 o'clock. Stay tuned now for Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Prez.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coop.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you. Bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. And you're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Real radio. From the concrete up. All the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all. One love.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And we're here. Actually, you see a lot of cars in Oakland. I'm not on the Bay Bridge like I was yesterday, but there's a little bit of a traffic jam where I'm standing at now. But I'm with Alicia, and she is one of the people that is down with Black Seed. Black Seed, of course, the organization that put together the direct action protest that took place on the Bay Bridge yesterday. You know, we were just talking off mic, and, you know, I was way back. You know, and I was halfway up the span, and I was there on my way to the city, had to go to the bathroom, everything stopped, and, you know, people were jumping out their cars, taking pictures, you know, and I don't think a lot of people knew there was a protest initially, because people were just taking pictures on the side. They were like, I'm going to get a picture of the selfie on the bridge and all that, but then, you know, we found out there was a protest, and then everybody jumped up and tried to get pictures, but we couldn't see everything that was going on.
From your perspective, obviously you being one of the people that was there, what happened, what inspired you all to do this, and what have you?
Yeah, so I organized with Black Seed, which is a queer black liberation collective of folks. And so we organize around direct action and also around different community issues, like land reclamation, freedom fighter exchanges, things like that. And so we were, as we were kind of going through our work, doing our work in community response and all of that, one of the things we saw was that there were a lot of folks who were being murdered by the police and experiencing police brutality in relation to health-related trauma and health-related issues. And so folks were trying to call emergency services to get support and to get health support, and then either being arrested because they had a warrant, or then there being some kind of case of police brutality because they didn't know how to deal with the situation. And so we saw that happening.
Or people just getting killed.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, so we saw that happening and noticing that there was this trend of folks who were being criminalized and murdered for needing health support. And then also connecting that to some of the work around gentrification and homelessness and jails, and knowing that those are things that impede our health all the time. They impede our mental health and our physical health and our emotional health. And so really wanting to be able to connect those things together and realizing that it was not a way that things were being framed all the time as Black health mattering, and really wanting to bring things together of our health and our wellness and our thriving and our ability to live being important, especially considering that Black folks have a lower life expectancy than white folks and non-Black POC folks for these reasons, for the gentrification, the homelessness, the brutality, all of those things. And so for us, it was a drastic situation. And so when there are drastic circumstances, we take drastic measures. And that's what we've seen historically, that our ancestors and our elders have done. And so we felt really inspired by the march that happened across the Edward Pettus Bridge in Selma. And we were like, how do we channel our ancestors and our elders in this work? And it seemed like the Bay Bridge was the best place to do that.
You know, the narrative that was put forth is that people were angry, that your message, the message from Black Seed would get lost. Why do the Bay Bridge? Why inconvenience people? Those type of narratives. What's your response to them?
Well, we know that if everybody was allowed to live their lives comfortably, we wouldn't be fighting. We would have no reason necessarily to fight if everything was able to be easy and comfortable and just we were able to carry on with business as usual. So we have to stop business as usual because we're not allowed to live our lives in a calm, easy way. And so sometimes we have to take greater extremes and shut things down and shut down business as usual to bring people's attention to things. If we were marching around the block and it was a really quiet march, it might be impactful, but it wouldn't have the same reach and it might not have the same impact, and the messaging might not have the same potential to be carried to folks around the city, around both in San Francisco and in Oakland, and then also nationally, for folks to look at and see, what are these folks doing? Why are they doing this? And bringing those things together.
I know you mentioned the inspiration was looking at King. It was the King weekend, mm-hmm. and the march around the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Mm-hmm. Just for people who don't know the story around the Selma voting rights march and what that meant, many people saw the movie Selma, but I would encourage people, if they get a chance, to watch the Eyes on the Prize episode of that. And you can actually see the tensions that were around. You hear the governor, like, it's going to be against the law if you walk across the bridge. It's going to endanger the public, all these sorts of things. Some rhetoric that we heard people say about you all yesterday. And, you know, the response was very harsh, you know. And at one point, a judge put a federal order, injunction, to say that they couldn't march across the bridge. I'm not sure if they showed that exactly in the movie, but they marched anyway. And in fact, when King turned around, because he's trying to parse the line, he turned around, the people that came with him were like, what the hell you mean you turned around, as well as the members from SNCC.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, you needed to go further. So I bring this up because, you know, now they're heroes. We celebrate them. We hold them up. We learn about them in school. And people talk about how courageous they were. But what they were trying to do oftentimes was bring attention to the issue, make people talk about it. And in the case, in some of those cases, they were looking for the confrontations so that they could demonstrate to people just how crazy stuff was. But with that being said, you know, you mentioned King, but what comes to mind here for me and many people in the Bay Area, and the fact that Black Seed is a queer-led organization, is the historic work of ACT UP, who did all that direct action stuff around HIV and AIDS. In 1989, they stopped traffic on the Bay Bridge. I mean, they brought more people than y'all did and really kicked up dust. Do you make that connection with that history and that lineage? Not that LGBT folks always have to be associated with HIV and AIDS, but at that time, that's where the fight was. And it was connected with those fights and discrimination and people being like, oh, that's what you all deal with, and we don't deal with that.
Absolutely. We're always trying to build more history and to learn more of that history around what folks were doing, you know. To go back as far as folks doing work with the Panthers and with the Brown Berets, and then also looking at ACT UP and SLAM and organizers who started the organizations like Fierce over in New York and the Audre Lorde Project and those organizations, to see what those folks have been doing kind of historically and how they got started and why they got started. And looking at, I mean, ACT UP, their direct action tactics were incredible and were both incredibly strategic and incredibly organized, but also incredibly visual and engaging, and the aesthetic was really on point. And so that's one of the things that we talk about a lot in our queer organizing spaces, is that those are the things that we want to hold to. We sometimes have seen really kind of traditional patriarchal organizing and very heteronormative organizing that happens, and it's a march and it's somber and it's very, like, sometimes a little boring, and, you know, people, they come together for an issue and the issue is important, but it doesn't always have the same kind of festive, upbeat feel and that aesthetic and all of those things. And so I think one of the things that's important is that it's been queer organizers who have been bringing that into spaces all the time, and that it's been queer folks working alongside straight folks and cis folks and cisgendered folks to kind of bring those things. And so I think that's one of the things we think about a lot, is how does our organizing really hold our aesthetic and our bodies and our being as queerness, as queer folks, and holding the nuance that we carry in our day-to-day lives.
When ACT UP did that in 1989, there was criticism, harsh criticism actually, from folks that were part of what people might say is more of the mainstream organizations around what they did. The concern was that the message would be taken away, it would be lost, people would be focused on the anger they felt from being inconvenienced, all that sort of stuff. With that in mind, what Black Seed is doing when they're talking about Black atrocities and, you know, Black death and all that, there are Black organizations, you know, that aren't queer or don't have a lot of queer members who are fighting that fight. Did you get that sort of pushback and criticism, you know, at the same time you all were doing this, do the big old march, you know, more in the traditional sense, you know, the Reclaim King march? How did people feel about that?
I mean, we work really closely with the Anti-Police Terror Project, both in our work doing community response and first responders things, and then also around this weekend, knowing that they're the ones who put that call out, working with them to kind of figure out what makes more sense for this, you know. How do we, if we're going to do this, then how would it fit into the narrative that y'all are building? Which is why we wanted to be strategic about having it later on in the day, so that most of the march would be wrapping up and there would be the program happening portion of the march, and that there wouldn't be any kind of media derailment from that, and there wouldn't be any kind of people derailment from that, but that folks could make an easy shift from the march to what we were doing, and have it not be in competition with each other, because we know that that's what capitalism and white supremacy wants us to do. They want to divide us and have us pitted against each other, and we're like, no, that's not the rules that we're playing by. We're going to work with these folks. We may have different organizations that we organize with on a regular basis where we build political homes, but our political homes can be on the same block. Right. And we can talk to each other. We can, like, go to each other's gardens. That's what we do. And that's what we have to do as organizers as we build a movement.
You know, one of the things I saw on the bridge was, like, an altar. Mm-hmm. And that altar had the names of everybody. You know, the Alex Nietos. It was brown, black, indigenous folks. Talk about that, because I think part of the narrative was like, oh, just black people and other people are getting killed. But I saw those altars, and I know the type of programming that was taking place all weekend was very deliberate in connecting Oakland and San Francisco. And there was lots of space and lots of conversation about how these issues are affecting people broadly.
Absolutely. And we know that one of the only differences between most of our Latino community and most of our and folks who are in the Bay Area, who are Mexican American, who are Salvadorian, who are Taino, who are Dominican, who are Puerto Rican, however they identify, the only difference between our slave masters and theirs is that theirs spoke Spanish and ours spoke English. So we know that we have the same history. It looks a little different. It's a little geographically different. Our indigenous folks and the spaces that we existed in were different. But we have a really similar trajectory in that way. And so in the same way that for us in Black Seed, we define black as being of the African diaspora. And we know that in large part, a lot of our Latino sisters and brothers and siblings are also part of that African diaspora. So those folks are just as black as we are. And may not always name themselves that way. And there's room for that, for folks to have that kind of self-determination and that autonomy. But we know that they're as black as we are. And so, and also considering that historically, indigenous folks in what's now the United States and what is now South America were not enslaving Africans prior to the colonization of Europe onto what is currently the Americas. So we have a lot of solidarity with those folks, and it's important to build that solidarity, especially around genocide and the way that indigenous folks have had genocidal treatment and have experienced genocide because of European colonization. And it's the same way that black folks, brown folks, black folks who speak Spanish have experienced that same genocide.
Well, it seemed like you had a lot of people out there. I saw people of all stripes getting arrested, so it looks like you all had allies out there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was a really wonderful thing to see. We especially had a lot of we had some white folks who had shown up who wanted to be supportive, and some non-black people of color who had shown up to be supportive. And a lot of those were from our queer and trans people of color groups and some queer affinity groups that are part of some white organizing groups. And I think that was also one of the amazing things, is to be able to bring folks into the same space who may not always be in the same space, but really have similar reasoning for doing the work, because they believe in the message around black health mattering and the fact that we need more health care, more wellness, and less warfare and less imperialism.
We're talking with Leisha from Black Seed, if you're just tuning in. The tactic that you all use, the cars being synchronized, chaining everything together, I saw that in Ferguson. Were y'all inspired, or did y'all get that tactic of having cars do that from Ferguson?
Absolutely. Well, we study and have conversations with each other. You know, that's the work I was talking about earlier, the Freedom Fighter Exchange. That's what that's all about, is being able to share knowledge and information from folks around the country, and be able to have our folks go to those places and work and see what folks are doing, and have those folks be able to come here and see what we're doing. And so we were definitely inspired by folks in Ferguson who were doing those kind of organizing methods. We were also inspired by folks in Charlotte, North Carolina, who did a funeral procession after Jonathan Farrell was murdered, and they drove 5 miles per hour down the freeway with a block of cars. And so we were inspired from Charlotte to Ferguson to folks in the Bay Area who we've been working with, who have been shutting things down all through the past year in all different kinds of ways.
What's the message, and what would be the response that, you know, you did this action, what's the response that you want to have take place? And I'm asking this knowing that over the weekend, this 96 hours of direct action, Libby Schaff was visited, and Mayor Ed Lee and the police chief in Oakland and Frisco were all, you know, delivered hand messages, handwritten or eviction notices or what have you, but they were all protested. Some people have made the case, why not go to City Hall? Why inconvenience thousands when, you know, you should take it to the people who make these decisions and don't make these decisions? Your thoughts on that, the fact that they were protested this weekend, what are you all hoping to get out of this?
So I guess for me and for us, it's not really an either or. We do that. So we shut down City Hall and City Council this past year in Oakland. We shut down the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco this past year when they were trying to get a jail built in San Francisco. We went to Libby's house last year. Folks went to Ed Lee's house and Sir's officer's house and Wentz's house this year. So it's
both City, Oakland, and San Francisco chief of police.
Absolutely. We shut down the OPD, the Oakland Police Department. And so it's not an either or, it's a both and. We need to do all of these things to have our message and our demands met, our message heard and our demands met. And so some of those demands being to fire Chief Sir, to fire Chief Went, and to fire the officers involved in the murder of Mario Woods, to have money reallocated from police budgets into housing, into mental health care, and so really hoping to push those demands. And so we do a lot of different things in order to push those demands, and a lot of different things to engage people. So I feel like our actions are as much about pushing our messaging and getting our message out to different folks as it is an organizing tactic, a way of building relationships with new people, so that we can continue to have those conversations and figure out ways to be more strategic in our organizing and our movement building.
Yesterday, when I was on the bridge, I had reported that the atmosphere was very supportive and jovial even. Mm-hmm. People were passing out snacks. You know, there are pictures. There was women walking around with balloons, people taking selfies, all sorts of things. And that was a very different experience versus the narrative of reporters who, I can tell you for a fact, were not there where we were. Now, there were reporters that were allowed in from the other side. Some of them were police escorted. They were able to drive through the traffic. So, you know, the whole thing about, oh, the emergency vehicles. Well, you know, I have a picture of news vans driving right up the bridge in the middle of all that traffic. And then, you know, you saw it, and the police were directing them and letting them come out and do the interviews and all that. So they managed to get there. So I'm sure that any emergency vehicle with the phantom patients that everybody says is the reason you shouldn't do that, could have gotten through there just as easily. But I bring this up for a couple of reasons. One, the contention that blocking traffic puts people in jeopardy and will really get this adverse reaction, and it won't have any impact. I look at, you know, the blocking of traffic with groups like Critical Mass, which has been going on 20 years, and folks who are old enough may remember that there were popular radio DJs who, as a joke, did a similar thing. They pulled up five vans on the Bay Bridge at the height of rush hour and backed up traffic for 10 hours. Mm-hmm. The end result was they got hired by Clear Channel, got million-dollar contracts, and their ratings skyrocketed. So I'm asking because if you have these success stories, Critical Mass, you look around, there are bike lanes all over the place. And you know, not to last Friday of the month, you know, like downtown is their world, right? Why the response with them being one of tolerance and even something that is highlighted as, well, this is what they do when you come to the Bay Area, you can experience that. Or you have people that have been rewarded, you know, financial gain for messing up, you know, and inconveniencing people. But the narrative around Black Seed and other organizations is one of vitriol. What is that about?
I think that it's folks are creative, and folks know that they can't be racist and they can't indulge white supremacy in the same ways that it's been enacted historically. And so folks are really creative in how they choose to impart racism on folks. And so we know that the reason that we experience a different kind of vitriol and the reason we experience a different kind of anger is for the fact that we live in black bodies and that we organize in black bodies, and that there is still to this day, in this moment, as much as people might want to say that it doesn't exist, anti-blackness that really is deeply rooted in a lot of our ways of being and a lot of our societies and in a lot of the ways that people look at different things. Right. So we know it's because of an anti-black racism that folks don't want to see us get free. Folks don't want to see us organizing around that. It's much easier for people to not have to look at us, for people, for us to just be passive and kind and just say thank you. And we say thank you when we're locked into things, right, when people are helpful. But we're not practicing that same kind of respectability politic that we know has not always been helpful in getting us free and helping us achieve liberation.
The fact that you saw these successes mm-hmm. with other groups, does that become a strategy that you look at and say, well, if critical mass can block traffic and mm-hmm. really get political gain and notoriety and power, or if you can have, you know, radio DJs block traffic during rush hour and wind up with multi-million-dollar contracts as a result, does that inform a decision for you guys to do similar type of things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we see those kind of those history stories of those large scale events where folks are blocking traffic and then having their demands and their needs met, then we're like, okay, so then that's a thing that can happen. And then also for many of us in our own organizing, we've experienced different kinds of success where we have seen times where we have shut down different, like I said, we shut down City Hall, we shut down Board of Supervisors meetings, and we saw that lead to success. We know that they're not building a jail in San Francisco, and before the Board of Supervisors meeting was shut down with some of the same equipment that was used yesterday, they were going to build a jail. So we've seen success with our gear, and we've seen success on those streets, and we've seen success in our communities. So when you put all of those together, there's no reason that we shouldn't be able to have our demands met.
My last question for you, Alicia. When the BART trains were stopped a year ago, that was a year-long fight with the threat of federal charges being levied on folks, and people were, you know, being told they would have to pay $70,000 in fine, and we're looking at jail terms. And those 14, those Black Friday 14, stood fast, said not one dime, didn't compromise at all. But the question became, why the selective harshness for that? Mm-hmm. If you recall, mm-hmm. there were people that were from Stanford that shut down the San Mateo Bridge last year.
Yeah.
And they all graduated and did mm-hmm. things, and they learned from their class, and mm-hmm. you didn't have the same. Mm-hmm. There ain't nobody doing 7, 8, you know, they're not looking mm-hmm. at the jail terms that the Black Friday 14 were looking at.
Right.
Do you fear by doing this that there will be that sort of, like, you know what, because it's you guys, let's throw the book at you?
I mean, I think a good organizing tactic is to always be engaged with our history and always be in looking at those, the ways that people have been prosecuted and the way that there has been legal cases waged against people. And so that's definitely something that I kept in mind and when I was deciding to lock down amongst all of the folks that I locked down with. And I know something that everybody else that I was there with was thinking about were those legal cases that have come against people. But I think, you know, one of the other groups that I do a lot of work with is BYP 100. And what they say is, we ready, we coming. And that's what we say is, we know that there can be a fight, but we're ready to fight that fight. We're ready for that fight. We have our squad around us. We have our crew around us. We know they're ready to support us. They have our backs. So we coming.
Well, there you have it. Alicia, we appreciate it. Appreciate you taking time out. Black Seed is the organization she is a part of. They were the ones that brought those cars up on the bridge and locked the chains and threw the windows of the car and shut down traffic. And it made people have to stop and think on this Martin Luther King weekend.
And, you know, and as we close out, you know, I think it's important that people remember the history of bridges and traffic being shut down, not just in this country, but definitely here in the Bay, from the ACT UPS to the Chuy Gomez's and Mancal Mullers, who did it as the radio plank, to, you know, other folks that have gone on, the critical masses and people who, I forget what's the name of the organization, but it wasn't too long ago that people were lying down on railroad tracks to prevent oil and contaminants from coming into the bay. And sometimes those efforts are cheered, other times they're rewarded, and sometimes they are demonized, and you have people saying all kind of crazy things. But we have to ask ourselves why the contradictions and what that's about and what's driving that. Were you really mad about being inconvenienced, or were you just mad about the message, or were you mad at the people that were doing it? That's something for all of us to think about. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Later. Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from the hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, listening to the hard knocks, learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, listening to the hard knocks.
Hey folks, you're tuned to Hard Knock Radio. I'm Marie Cha. Early Saturday morning, protesters visited the homes of both Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf and Oakland Police Chief Sean Wendt to demand their resignations. They delivered a stay-away order to Police Chief Wendt and an eviction notice to Mayor Schaaf to demand justice in the murders of seven black people killed by Oakland police officers since Schaaf took office. None of the officers involved have been fired. Protesters also charged Schaaf with accelerating the displacement of black and brown communities. I spoke with Jason Wallach and Jenny Kogan with showing up for racial justice at the protests outside of Mayor Libby Schaaf's home.
How would you characterize how Libby's relationship to what we're seeing around policing, how is that different from previous mayors?
You know, it's important to look at the historical context. And I think we should actually give some credit to the previous administration for having addressed some of these issues. And I think Gene Kwan's administration demonstrates that when you actually make a commitment to, you know, changing the rules of engagement and creating an ethic around respecting life, what you get is actually that police don't shoot people in the streets. That only comes with constant vigilance on the part of city leadership. I think there's a tendency to kind of regress towards the lowest common denominator, which is basically police doing whatever they want to do. And for all the critique that I have of that administration, I credit it with that ability to provide that vigilance. That's completely been abandoned under this current mayor, and this is who we're calling out and why we're calling her out. Eight black lives in Oakland is eight too many, and any city official that doesn't account for the fact that black folks are being murdered by Oakland police is not fit to be in office, and that's why we're calling for her resignation.
Y'all are out here today specifically as a group of white folks. I mean, why is that so important?
We really focus on organizing folks in white communities and majority white communities because white supremacy in Oakland so much depends on the silence of white folks to just acquiesce to these machinations of injustice that kind of roll and grind on the daily. It's really amazing when, in our work, what we do is we kind of take the news from black and brown communities to white folks in churches, white folks in unions and other spaces around Oakland, and there's a point for many white folks, as you know, and we're talking about folks who are 40, 50 years old, they're professionally developed, and they realize, oh my God, my comfort, my well-being, my wealth, all of this stuff, they, when they start to put the pieces together around racial injustice, they realize that they've been living in a world of in which myself or they as a white person is being propped up by all of these injustices. It's impacting for that individual. And so what Surge really wants to do is provide a space for that person to step up and stand up and speak up to create a just world and create some justice both on the city and national levels.
One of the things that you spoke to was, you know, really making the connections between the gentrification that we're seeing happening all over Oakland and the murders of black people at the hands of police. How are you seeing that reflected in broader trends?
As white people move into neighborhoods that are primarily populated by black and brown populations, white people are scared and are calling the police for petty offenses, and calling the police to check in on petty offenses has nothing to do with stopping serious crimes, but it does make the police target the already marginalized groups more. So in San Francisco, the number of 311 calls, which are non-emergency, what are also known as quality of life calls, have increased by 300% between 2009 and 2014. And a lot of people these days are taking their phones and making it as unconfrontational as possible and texting the police, dirty sidewalks or graffiti saying, come out now, and police are taking action. So just the number of people being scared of their community and calling the police for very petty crimes has increased significantly, while the black population in San Francisco has decreased significantly.
One of the things that I often hear in white communities, but also in just more affluent communities, regardless of race, is this narrative that, well, the police are here to keep us safe, and that when there are situations like this, it's either the result of a few bad apples or because the individual did something wrong.
Right.
So when you come up against that sort of narrative, like, how do you all respond?
Well, that's kind of the first line of defensiveness that a lot of the white folks that we, you know, when we first engage with folks, that's what they come up with. It's like, well, Demoria Hogg, he was parked on an off-ramp off of 580. He was probably, why do you just park on an off-ramp? The white person who hasn't really kind of engaged with these issues oftentimes is going to be that person who speaks the first thing that comes to their head, right? And our job really is to say, wait, examine that thought. Think about why, how that got there. Examine your thought process, because just because you're thinking something doesn't necessarily mean it's your thought. And we have to talk about the machinations of white, of how white supremacy kind of replicates itself. And it replicates itself in the brains of white folks or people who identify as white. This is the challenge, right? Is to get people to really take on that self-reflection of saying, like, well, did Demoria Hogg deserve to be shot dead because he made a decision to park his car on an off-ramp? I mean, that's where you start to see this cognitive dissonance, and it starts to jam the circuits.
This is MLK Weekend, and this is the second year that we've seen this 96 hours of direct action around MLK Weekend. Is there anything about King's legacy that you think is particularly relevant this year and in this time that we're in?
Yes, there's two things, really. I mean, one, I think for folks who are gathered here today, from showing up for racial justice at Mayor Schaaf's house. We spoke a lot this week during the planning about how Martin Luther King was killed by white racists, white supremacist racists. And there is a long tradition of people stepping up to those forces of white supremacy, you know, the open forces of white supremacy in our society. And you know, we've been really reflective this week about who represent those forces today and how do we, as white folks, challenge them and do the real work of confronting these folks where they're at to prevent the spreading and the replication and reproduction of white supremacy. The second thing I would say about MLK is I would just direct folks to reread and revisit his letter from the Birmingham jail, which was scribed on April 16th, 1963. About halfway through the letter, Martin Luther King clearly states that he's more worried about the white moderate than he is about the KKK. And he sees the white moderate as a person who kind of gives lip service to black liberation or black and brown liberation without actually acknowledging that he or she as a white person must be involved on the side and fall in solidarity with the demands of those movements. That's why today it's so critical for us to say, yes, we want Libby Schaaf to resign. She's not fit for office, because when black and brown communities say that, it's not heard at City Hall. And then you see white organizations coming along and they're saying, oh, well, that's cool that you guys feel that way. We're with you, but we're just like, we just want to call for accountability. No, we are showing up for racial justice Bay Area. We're in solidarity. We're in lockstep with our black and brown brothers and sisters, trans lives, folks. Everybody in this city who's fighting for justice in black and brown communities, we're calling for Mayor Libby Schaaf's resignation right along with you.
That was Jason Wallach and Jenny Kogan with Showing Up for Racial Justice protesting outside of Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf's home. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh. When the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory, glory, glory. Oh, glory, glory.
Hey folks, you're tuned to Hard Knock Radio. I'm Marie Cha. This Sunday, protesters in San Francisco answered the call for 96 hours of direct action to reclaim King's radical legacy. They began by issuing early morning wake-up calls to both San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr and San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee. At Mayor Lee's house, protesters with Asians for Black Lives set a table and called on Mayor Lee to come out for a Serve the People breakfast. On the menu, Fire Police Chief Suhr and all officers involved in the murders of Mario Woods, Alex Nieto, and Amilcar Lopez, and reallocate the police budget to create stable, affordable housing for black and brown communities in San Francisco. At Police Chief Suhr's house, protesters with the last 3% of black San Francisco hung dirty laundry on his door, laid effigies of dead bodies in the street, and called for his resignation.
I say good morning, Chief Suhr!
Good morning, Chief!
Is as hard as the concrete our brother died on.
Is as hard as the concrete our brother died on.
This is for the parents still waiting.
This is for the parents still waiting.
For their sons and daughters to come home.
For their sons and daughters to come home.
Thank you all for being here. We're going to continue to wake up this morning. Because we want people to really wake up and understand what it feels like to be in our shoes.
Right.
What it feels like to be black in America, in this country, in this world. Before we are even born, we have targets on our very existence.
Yes.
Our lives are often decided before our feet even hit the earth. Many don't understand what it's like to walk, not be able to walk around the streets just because of the color of your skin.
Yeah.
Worried about being gunned down by a police officer.
Okay.
Just because he thinks you look like a criminal.
Yes.
Yes.
This community can't relate to our struggle.
Hmm.
No matter if they try to read it in a book or listen to it in a rap song.
Yes.
They will never know what it's like to walk in our shoes, to be displaced from our homes.
Yes.
To cringe when you see a police officer.
Yes.
Not necessarily because you are in fear, but because you are in rage.
Hmm.
So we want you and your community to know what it looks like to be inconvenienced.
Huh.
What it feels like to be inconvenienced.
Wake up.
We want you to wake up, not just physically this morning, but also mentally.
Yes.
And also spiritually.
Yeah. Wake up.
so that when we say Black Lives Matter, you know exactly what we mean so much that you feel it in your bones. We ain't doing this just for our health. We're doing this for our ancestors. Those who fought 50 years ago for the same blood that was shed on the streets now that's shed now. Then that's shed now.
Pancakes not included.
Before there was a Mario Woods, there was an Oscar Grant. Before there was an Oscar Grant, there was an Emmett Till. And before that, there was the Middle Passage. Let us not forget why we are here. When we say we're shutting it down, we mean what we say when we are shutting it down. Because until we are able to breathe in this country, we are going to continue to make an impact on this system in any way that we can. If that means coming to your house at 4 o'clock in the morning. People want to talk about an inconvenience? What's an inconvenience is not having a loved one at the dinner table. Because a police officer decided they wanted to be God that day. What's an inconvenience is going into a school classroom and being labeled a dummy just because they don't understand your culture. What's an inconvenience is not having adequate resources. What's an inconvenience is being homeless or being displaced from your home. Just because this country cares more about money than they care about the safety of those who are melanated people. So we don't want to hear about an inconvenience this morning. What we want to hear is that you're going to stand up for what's right. Don't let a uniform strip you of your humanity. Don't let a title let you forget where you came from. Because we are the original people. We are gods. Which is why this country does nothing but try to exploit us and create representations of fear of what they know to be great. So I don't know about y'all, but I'm fired up this morning. Because San Francisco got us up. If they think we're not going to continue to fight.
That was the opening of the Wake Up Chief Sir action that took place this Sunday morning at 4 a.m. at Chief Sir's home in the Sunset. There, I caught up with Renisha Johnson. She's with the last 3% of Black San Francisco. I started by asking her to describe what was happening.
Lifting up the case of Mario Woods, which is a 26-year-old young man, African-American male, who was shot down by San Francisco Police Department about a month ago. And Chief Sir directly should be held accountable for the murder of Mario Woods because he has made several statements basically justifying the behavior of San Francisco Police Department for the perpetuating the genocide against Black communities. And then also when we think about the track record of Chief Sir, since he's been in office, he's basically has been involved in misconduct and then also extortion of the San Francisco Police Department, which is further perpetuates the same type of oppression against communities of color, in which we want to lift up as well too. So in order for us to achieve justice for this case, we feel like it's only right if Chief Sir basically holds himself accountable and resigns from office, and we want to lift that up as our demands in relationship to this case, but also just justice in San Francisco in general.
Talk a little bit about the impact that the shooting of Mario Woods has had on folks, particularly in the Bay View community here in San Francisco.
Yeah, the impact of Mario Woods has definitely been strong in the Bay View community. And I also think it's extremely significant because it's basically an example of the Black struggle and the intersectionality between gentrification and I think police violence that is often overshadowed. And, you know, thinking about the Mario Woods case and how his family is a product of gentrification. There's a direct relationship between gentrification and police violence, specifically in San Francisco, because we know that the Black community has the largest out-migration throughout the whole country, specifically in San Francisco, outside of Hurricane Katrina. And then we also have seen over the summer different initiatives from the San Francisco Police Department to increase the budget. It's not a coincidence that, you know, they wanted to increase the San Francisco Police Department budget by $400 million and also to build a new jail at the same time that Mario Woods was gunned down.
Coming out of the surfacing of the video, of incredible public outreach around this shooting, one of the things that Chief Sir has been pushing for and a measure that's been touted as an effective reform is to give police tasers and increase the use of body cameras. Yeah. I mean, talk a little bit about that.
I think it's just an opportunity to pacify the community. Tasers aren't going to stop or get rid of or eliminate racial bias, which is, I think, the root of disproportionality that we see within the police department. And we know that tasers, the officers who shot Oscar Grant had tasers. And we know that, you know, 41% of taser deaths in the United States are African-American people. So I think to say that you're going to get tasers or spend more money, you know, within the police department instead of providing resources for the community does nothing but doesn't make any sense.
In addition to the resignation or the firing of Chief Sir and the officers that have been involved, not just in the Mario Wood shooting, but also Alex Nieto, Amacoro Lopez, et cetera, what are the steps that you want to see the city take to address some of the root causes?
What I want the city to do to address some of the root causes, I think it's to start with those cases, is to be accountable and transparent to the community with these processes. I think thinking about the track record of Chief Sir and just a lot of those officers who have been involved in those shootings is that when we look at their track records or their history, there's a lot of misconduct that has not been reported or been transparent to the community. So I feel like that's a start. I think the mayor and also Chief Sir are always riding on this principle of creating trust between the police, you know, building that relationship. And in order for, you know, we can't talk about that happening if we aren't transparent about what the processes are of holding officers accountable. What needs to happen in relationship to this case is that there needs to be a public apology. And we have all of this money being put into these governing boards, like the African-American Board, police relations, relations that don't necessarily have direct representation of members of the community, which is extremely important. We have individuals who have been in those positions over the years who don't necessarily represent the demands or the needs of the community right now. And I think it's extremely important that we restructure those outlets as well, too.
What are the particular things about King's legacy that you want folks to keep in mind?
When we think about King's legacy, we often are fed this fabricated version, and we think of him as being very passive, and people like to always talk about his notion of diversity and love for all people. But Dr. King was, you know, a very radical activist in the sense of lifting up issues, you know, workers' rights and the black community, in which people don't talk about. I think it's important that when we talk about Dr. King's legacy, that we often reiterate that.
That was Renisha Johnson with the last 3% of Black San Francisco protesting outside of Police Chief Greg Sir's home in the Sunset in San Francisco. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. I'm Marie Cha. Stay with us.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom lands. Ain't gonna let police violence turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let police violence turn us around. We gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom lands. Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. We gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom lane.
Bug is is 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. It is now 5 p.m. Please stay tuned. Up next is Flashpoints.